The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, WSFM LP Asheville, or Friends of Community Radio. You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville, North Carolina. Also on ashevillefm.org. This is the Final Straw, and I'm Bert Sogoodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for critique, criticism, ideas, whatever, at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week we're speaking with Neil Shirley and Sarah Lee Stafford about their new book, Dixie Be Damned, 300 Years of Insurrection in the American South, just published by AK Press. The book is a look at insurrections, riots, and revolts in the Southeast U.S. from colonization onward against white supremacy, racism, and patriarchy by a number of different communities and subjects. More on the book can be found at akpress.org. A quick note on Sean's condition before we start this segment. Sean Swain continues to be in communication blackout at the moment. According to officials, he's still in his cell, not in the hole or the hospital, but he's on some sort of Kafka-esque status of communication restrictions, meaning no outgoing JPay email, video chat, or phone calls. His support website hasn't received communication from him since the 11th. There are suggestions of how you can help Sean get out of the circumstance at seanswain.org. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Come like a bomb! I have many times heard historians argue that the U.S. lost in Vietnam because those in charge did not understand the reality on the ground. Yeah, the reality on the ground. But if those in charge don't know the reality on the ground, what other reality is there? Hierarchy is good at producing delusional hierarchs, all too practiced in not seeing the reality on the ground. To recap, the false mythology of the hierarchs is built on a right to rule, which imposes a duty to obey, both of which have no rational basis in reality. The false mythology of the hierarchs asserts that government protects and defends freedom, when the very opposite is provably true in reality. And the false mythology of the hierarchs views the catastrophic consequences of 8,000 years of hierarchy as signs of success and progress rather than evidence of abysmal failure. As I already argued, you must be delusional to be a hierarch. You have to accept false realities. But being a hierarch doesn't just require you to be crazy, it makes you crazy. The hierarch delusion compels you to accept the total preposterous as true. So we get good at it. We pretend our teachers are imparting valuable knowledge to serve us in gaining employment that will be satisfying and fulfilling. We pretend doddering old pedophiles have a hotline to a fantastical, self-contradictory God. We pretend bosses don't rob us of our time and labor. We pretend wars and prisons are necessary. We pretend economies are real things. We pretend colored pieces of paper with dead slave owners' faces on them are really worth something. And it goes on and on. But that's the kind of internal dishonesty you need when you're trapped in hierarchy, a system that is to human social organization what an ice cream truck is to interplanetary spaceflight. No matter how much you tinker with it and modify it, it ain't gonna work. All the duct tape in the world can't fix it. When we view hierarchy as a pathology, as a mental illness, as a mass delusion, we recognize that millions are trained from birth, generation after generation, for thousands of years, not to see the reality on the ground. Millions are trained to believe that those in power have a right to rule, that the rest of us have a duty to obey, that government protects and defends freedom, that the rabble cannot be trusted to self-rule. That is, of course, the broken record of the hierarch delusion. But some deluded hierarchs are more enthusiastic about these false myths than others. They are so steeped in the pathology that they dedicate themselves to it entirely. They aren't satisfied to merely take orders, but believe themselves singularly qualified to give orders. They seek power over others. That means those who seek and gain positions of power are even more delusional than the poor hierarchs just going along with the miserable program. Back to the analogy, they don't want to be passengers. They want to fly the ice cream truck. So those who are in charge are necessarily more delusional than those following orders. And that means, in hierarchy, the more delusional you are, the more powerful you'll get. Since hierarchs are Fruit Loops, That means those hierarchs who seek power are Fruit Loopier, and those hierarchs who are most powerful are the Fruit Loopiest. That means anyone who has ever been in charge has been nuts. The hierarchiest of the hierarchs, the craziest of the crazies, the Fruit Loopiest of the Fruit Loops. That explains a lot. The George Bushes and Dick Cheneys and Richard Nixons of the world aren't more qualified than the Walmart manager or the city council member. They're more hopped up on the hierarch pathology. And the George Bushes, Dick Cheneys, and Richard Nixons are only slightly surpassed in hierarch craziness by the likes of Hitler, Mussolini, and Attila the Hun, who believed in hierarchy so deeply they wanted to run everything. With all the practice they've had since birth in avoiding it at all costs, no wonder those who assume the right to rule can never see the reality on the ground. That's not a virtue valued by the delusional hierarchs. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route number 728, Lucasville, Ohio 45699. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. We're speaking to the editors of a new history book out from AK Press, Dixie Be Damned, 300 Years of Insurrection. Oh, actually, what's the... 300 Years of Insurrection, right?
Yep, 300 Years of Insurrection in the American South.
Sarah Lee Stafford and Neil Shirley, come on down. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
No problem.
So, considering the relative popularity of regional histories and what this book is actually about, what brought you to write this book? And how does it diverge from what one might expect from a Southern history?
So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of regional histories out there, and Southern history is sort of its own genre that draws perhaps a niche but highly, highly fanatical crowd. So that is something we encountered when we first started talking about writing the book. You know, our take on it, first and foremost, was that we've read a lot of those histories but always found them really unsatisfactory in either even remotely dealing with the kinds of rebellious moments and social movements and whatnot that we deal with in our book. But when they do deal with them, there's these sort of very highly scripted narratives, choreographed almost, if you will, that seek to explain the kinds of social tension and social war that you see in the South. And, you know, the short answer to your question, I think, is just that we found those explanations highly unsatisfactory in actually explaining, you know, the roots of those tensions and what, you know, the kinds of conflict that happened in those rebellious moments and how those moments speak to today, right? How they speak to the present. And so, you know, we're anarchists. We sought to write a book about Southern, you know, conflict and social conflict and social war in the South that speaks to those politics, but also just that actually speaks to the present in general.
Well, and I think that while there is, you know, volumes and volumes of regional history specifically about the South written, there's not much to speak of regional history written by anarchists right now. And, you know, we hope that in doing this also it inspires others to kind of take on regions that they live in and look at, you know, inspiring histories of revolt from around different regions in the South, and not just the South, but the country. And I think furthermore, this problem that we have a lot as anarchists, especially Southern anarchists, is that we are constantly looking at history that's, you know, and in one sense, not our own for inspiration, whether it's to the big cities in the US or Europe. And I think for us, it was about trying to find things that resonated, because in order to have the history be relevant in your present, it is important to know about kind of what revolt has looked like in your own region.
To be a little more direct, Neil, when you were talking about tensions that get danced around, can you talk more explicitly about what kind of tensions you're talking about in terms of histories written of the South?
Yeah, absolutely. Something we deal head on with in the book, and that, you know, we sort of had this hypothesis as we were doing the research and, you know, from our own politics and experiences, but that became more and more frustrating and explicit as we learned more and as we just sort of, you know, talked as collaborators and thought more, was specifically like the way the progressive narrative has shaped the South. And I mean that in the broadest sense possible. I don't mean like left Democrat. I mean like any narrative that seeks a sort of progressive version of history. And so what that, you know, the specific examples like you're asking, you know, could be the way that people who do history with that narrative gloss over social conflicts that are inconvenient to this idea that progress with a capital P is something that happens gradually over time and inevitably, that it happens through modernity, industrialization, citizenship, the granting of rights from the state, et cetera. And so there's these pockets of conflict that we probably disproportionately focus on in the book. For example, after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, pockets of conflict during the Civil Rights Movement that break out of both rights and Black Power organizing models, labor conflict that breaks out of the workplace only model. So these are kinds of examples that we focus a lot on the book in which, you know, to give a very specific example from Reconstruction, a lot of the major social conflicts that emerge post-Civil War involve various populations of dispossessed, either, you know, for example, all Black communities of former slaves or mixed race communities of Indians and former slaves and poor whites in other areas of the South, challenging not just the former Southern regime, the former Confederate regime, but also simultaneously challenging the Northern models of redevelopment that bring in waged work, that bring in contracted labor, that bring in certain industry. And so they're fighting sort of a war on two fronts, one against this quote-unquote capital S South and one against quote-unquote the capital N North. And so that war, the fact that dispossessed people would actually burn down plantation property in rejection of the idea of labor contracts, in the rejection of paid labor, doesn't match with the traditional historical notion that slaves were trying to transition from slave labor to wage labor. And so it breaks with both the traditional, like, kind of lefty progressive vision, also the Marxist vision that people like Dubois, W.E.B. Dubois, would espouse.
Also, so in a lot of these registries, even, you know, leftist academic ones, you have that, you know, you have the problem that was that Reconstruction failed, right? That it was that, you know, the Southern backwardsness, and there was this failure to instill this Northern project. And so what we're looking at is not that it was a failure, but that it was also rejected.
Actively rejected
from the beginning.
So that's maybe a more specific example of what we were trying to dig into real deep and, you know, and get at this idea that, you know, the alternative to the traditional notions of, like, the conservative South that's posed by most folks as, like, rights, citizenship, democracy, it's not a real alternative, and that actually those things existed and came about as ways to contain social conflict. And, you know, that's a larger truth that's sort of taken for granted in anarchist discourse, but we wanted to dig really deep into Southern history and figure out how that's played out here. And we wrote this book for an audience at large, not just for Southerners, because a lot of the major conflicts in the United States that have determined where political economy has gone, where social movements have gone, have all honed in on the South. So, like, the major wars fought on this country's soil, Revolutionary War, the Civil War, really primarily deal with the question of what to do with labor and political economy in the South, what to do with potentially rebellious people in the South, specifically what to do with people of color, specifically African folks. And so that, you know, this history becomes to anyone interested in questions of social movements or recuperation or, you know, how social conflict is happening today.
When y'all talk about the American South, what are you pointing to? What does that signify geographically, historically, and culturally?
we're going to get in trouble for this one.
Yeah, this is one that we wrestled with a lot at the start of this project. One, because, of course, we wanted to include so much. You know, we wanted to think as broadly as we could about the South and include as much interesting conflict as possible. But obviously, you know, it's not possible. And we are already kind of recovering and working with a lot in the 200 some pages that exist now. But I think one of the ways is to look at where, and kind of a pre-Civil War idea and definition of the South in terms of how specifically slavery played out in the Southeast was an important marker. You know, what were the slave states? What were the states that did withdraw from the Union and engage that conflict? Because we knew we were going to be dealing with a lot of Civil War and post-Civil War land struggle, you know, and so that was really relevant. I think also a lot of it had to do with what we found and what we had access to and narratives that kind of found us in the process of writing the book. And so I think, you know, obviously, Neil and I have spent most of our lives in North Carolina. I've spent a lot of my life in Georgia. You see a lot of Appalachian struggle show up because those are histories that are really palpable when you're trying to look at these things like autonomy and kind of less politically motivated struggle. Appalachia always comes up. So I don't know. How else would you characterize
what do you mean by less politically motivated forms of struggle?
Well, what I mean by that is in the way that people defined how they were in conflict and what they were rebelling against and what they were working towards. And so we definitely were trying to find periods, you know, and areas of rebellion that were not kind of self-organized as Marxists, as socialists, even as anarchists, but were more organized through kinship, through ideas of in connection to land, through ideas in connection to various forms of dispossession. Does that make sense? Rather than for a specific political agenda, party, organization, platform.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that sort of anti-political bent, if you will, and I realize that's not a conventional use of the word, but I think Sarah Lee summed it up pretty well. But that anti-political bent, I think, becomes important for two reasons. One is that it speaks to our current political moment in the 21st century, where, you know, increasingly you're seeing riots erupt all over the country, all over the world, that don't betray an immediate politicality in the sense of, like, you can't point to it and label it very easily. You can't identify clear demands, mm-hmm. clear representatives, clear negotiators, until those people try and emerge from outside, kind of like the ambulance chasers of you know, whatever riot you're talking about. And so, because so much defines our current political moment and the moment that anarchists seek to intervene in and engage in, that makes the history in which, you know, in which social struggles also looked like that back in the day really important, because it speaks to the present. Mm-hmm. The other reason I think that anti-political bent is very important is because without it, you can't actually digest social conflict in the South, because mm-hmm. the South hasn't had a lot of the same degree of politicization of social movements that have happened in the Northeast, for example, or the Midwest areas like Chicago or the West Coast, where you have, you know, for example, large immigrant communities bringing very established philosophical isms like anarchism, socialism, communism into social movements and really giving a very clear political trajectory to those movements. That happened a lot less in the South for a huge array of reasons. And that's not to say, when we say that, you know, a social struggle isn't political, we're not saying that it doesn't involve visions of you know, new ways of living, new forms of life, that it doesn't involve questions of decision making or egalitarianism or questions of power dynamics or ethics of care or strategy. What we're saying is that it doesn't involve an institutionalization of narrative, of structure, if that makes sense. And I realize that's a little vague. But I think that becomes particularly important in the South because of how the South developed differently.
What stories do you focus on in your 7 chapters? Why did you choose those? And what are you hoping that the reader will derive from them?
I guess just to give an overview, the book starts in early 1700s and kind of along the colonial territories of Virginia, North Carolina, and the Great Dismal Swamp, looking at a kind of evolution from Indian wars against colonial settlements into maroonage as a form of both escape from plantations and slavery into a form of attack. So the Great Dismal Swamp was an area that was deeply feared and hated by colonial Europeans. They didn't understand that kind of geography. They didn't like the animals in it, and then it quickly became associated with territories that were controlled by escaped slaves. And so that area is, it's important, you know, not only because of how long of a period of revolt that went for, well into the 1800s, but also just from the beginning of the book, setting up the importance of the figure of the Maroon and the position, the social position of the Maroon, as not something that was just an identity formed out of like escape or running away from these systems, but directly engaged in attacking and trying to end slavery. So I think that's that creates like a strong basis for some of the kind of subjects that we look at throughout the rest of the book. And when we move on into the Civil War period, specifically in the Ogeechee area between the Ogeechee Rivers and coastal Georgia, where we are looking at the kind of struggle for land and autonomy and for a life without labor contracts that Ogeechee people were engaged in that area. So from in like 1868 to 1869, but definitely starting from the onset of the Civil War to well into like the early 1900s, along all those tracts of land that Sherman initially had kind of gifted back over to former slaves, and then that was immediately rescinded by Johnson. So looking at that, and then into another period of really interesting Reconstruction era revolt called the Lowry Wars, which was in coastal eastern North Carolina. It's an interesting juxtaposition to the Ogeechee struggle, because while the Ogeechee insurrection was pretty much entirely black former rice workers, former rice slaves, the Lowry Wars focuses on a multiracial banditry of Lumbee Indians, white poor Scotch-Irish whites who had kind of integrated into the Lumbee ethnic and cultural world, and also former slaves who had escaped and joined the Lumbee tribe, and their attacks on Reconstruction plantation society, like similar to Ogeechee, in that, you know, planters were returning to lands, trying to kind of reassert their power. At the same time, northern labor institutions like the Freedmen's Bureau were trying get people to go back to work through introducing of the wage contract or the labor contract, and so we see a lot of different forms of resistance in the Lowry's there. And then there's a little bit of a leap into the coal fields in Tennessee, and I'll let Neil talk for about a couple of chapters there.
So from there the book sort of takes a bent towards focusing on like what at first glance might be a more sort of traditional radical or like lefty history, in the sense of focusing on labor and labor battles. But the labor battles we choose to focus on are pretty specifically chosen to highlight aspects that challenge that model. So that the next chapter that comes to pass is called the Stockade Wars, which refers to a heightened period of conflict in the early 1890s in eastern and central Tennessee between black and white free coal miners, as well as almost entirely black prisoners, in conflict with various mostly northern-owned coal companies and railroad companies, as well as the actual state of Tennessee and the National Guard. And they're basically fighting against the convict lease, which is what a lot of listeners will be pretty familiar with probably, but was a system of re-enslavement by which almost entirely poor black folks were imprisoned for like small offenses, and then they're physically leased out to private companies to do their labor, especially in mining and in railroad, but that was, you know, also often timber as well in the Deep South. So they were fighting that system, which was a way to undermine the power of waged workers as well as exploit the dispossessed generally. So that resulted in a pretty unusual alliance of people fighting out of their own interests and social networks against those companies in the state of Tennessee. And, what comes to pass is that laborers and prisoners end up burning down company property, looting company property, and then setting prisoners free, giving them clothes and food, and helping them get out of the state. So you have a situation where, you know, southern white folks are actually freeing black prisoners and helping them get out of the state. And so some pretty unusual alliances develop in that context that we don't often read about or think about. It's not a typical workplace struggle, if you will. And then, we sort of skip with some interludes. We skip on to a wildcat struggle led by women also in eastern Tennessee, in the mills in 1929 in Elizabethton, Tennessee. It's a bit of a leap, but it involves similar issues at the fore. But we focus also as well a large degree on some of the gendered constructs that break down in the heat of a wildcat struggle at primarily two mills in Elizabethton, Tennessee in 1929. And those, you know, the dynamics of conflict internal to that movement, the ways that the union sort of helicopters in at the last moment to try and sort of negotiate the struggle, and how that dynamic plays out, and how that prophesies what's going to happen in central North Carolina with the much larger mill strike activity in starting in 1930. From there, the book goes on to focus on a period of civil rights as well as black power and urban riots that happens in the late 60s, sort of dealing with sort of digesting how the New Deal and how other government programs managed to kind of subsume and contain that period of radical labor conflict. And so what you see, you know, decades later is a lot of really heightened social conflict that deals directly with the identities around which some of those New Deal concessions avoid or sell out, right? So black folks, women, queer folks, things like that, movements like that. And so we deal next with urban riots that erupt beyond the boundaries of both civil rights and black power as narratives. And we sort of try and deal with some of the urban riots that have often been ignored in the South as emblematic of a kind of social struggle that can't be contained by a political narrative with a capital P. And so it exposes some of the limitations of black power and identity, as well as the rights framework that the civil rights movement is basing itself around. And then to sort of close out the book, the last chapter deals with a large women's prison rebellion in 1975 in Raleigh, North Carolina. We chose that because we wanted to focus on a prison struggle that hadn't been talked about much. We also chose it because we wanted to focus on something dealing with prisons just because of how that's emblematic of where political economy and institutions of control and exploitation are headed in that time period in the early and mid-70s. It sort of prophesies again sort of the world we live in today. And so we focus on a five-day uprising at a women's prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, and the sort of internal dynamics of that revolt and how activists sort of negotiated for it and within it, how the administrations dealt with containing it, et cetera, et cetera. And then we close out the book with a concluding sort of a more meta chapter that basically is our own notes for a historiography that might break beyond some of these leftist narratives of Southern history that we've been attempting to challenge throughout the book as a whole.
So the 40th anniversary of that struggle in the Raleigh Women's Prison is coming up in June. Is there anything going on, do you know?
There should be. it would be a great June 11th thing for people who celebrate June 11th as the, and I guess for listeners who don't know what that is, but it's the of remembering and celebrating a long-term anarchist and eco-prisoners struggles. But yeah, no, I mean, there absolutely should be.
Every Mother's Day, there's a big demo, which was just last Sunday at the, what's kind of closest to what was the North Carolina Correctional Center for Women. So it's basically the same facility in the same neighborhood. And that's, I think maybe because of that, it's hard to turn around and do a June event, but there definitely should be.
Yeah, I'm not trying to interrupt the flow of questions, but since y'all are going to be doing a book opening right around that time, the event will be spoken about in a public setting again, which is pretty damn cool.
Definitely. That's a really good point. We should bring that up.
You should just show up and, you know.
Yeah.
Go ham with that.
Throw bananas from the crowd.
I heard there. What's the
40th why don't we do anything for the 40th anniversary? Well, I don't know, sir. Who's that crazy man with a banana?
I warned you. Can you talk a little bit about the process of collaborating and writing this book? Like, do the chapters come out as in each of your voices, or do you find a different, not third position, but like fourth or fifth?
Well. That's deep. Collaborating has been one of, it's been, I think for both of us, one of the most like frustrating and surprising and just like kind of alchemical experiences of the last few years of my life. I think Neil and I have came about with, you know, into this project with a lot of affinity. And I think a lot of seeing a lot of each other in each other, if that makes sense. And being like, oh, we can work together. And then, you know, obviously... through any kind of deep collaborating, like writing a book together, I think we just were able to strike this balance where, you know, my writing background is deeply abstract and theoretical, and I had never written anything this kind of concrete and material before. And I think it was really helpful to have Neil's writing background, which is really different than mine, you know, to be able to force deadlines and also to just kind of know he's had, you know, 5 more years on me of writing. So I think we kind of ended up playing this dance between, you know, between deadlines and having to just like force stuff out and just get it done, and then also having a really good editing process between the two of us, and we both catch different things and see different things, and I don't know, it was just it's been really interesting.
Yeah, I feel like if like 2 or 3 years ago somebody had been like, you're going to collaborate with one person on a writing project for 2.5 years or 2 years or however long it's been, maybe 3 at this point, I would call them crazy and never want to do that. But I think because it emerged gradually, mm-hmm. we learned how to do it sort of over time in a way that was, you know, it wasn't like we were writing for a university that gave us a deadline. This is our own project that we're passionate about and that we have written in the cracks of the things we actually do with our lives, which are, you know, a lot of wage work and then a lot of, you know, actual political activity in the streets and projects that we, you know, that are our primary priority, I think. And so, you know, and all the friendships and ethics of care that have to come along with those things, those always take priority. And so this is a project that emerged, I think, in the cracks of those events. And I feel like, at least for me, I got a lot better at collaborating without an appropriate amount of space for it to take up and ways to communicate about it. But it's an intense thing. I mean, I think for anybody who's listening, I mean, everybody knows if you ever try to just write text for a flyer with another person, it can be really hard. You know, you can kind of be like two bulls with horns slamming into each other about it. But to try, you know, try doing that for 3 years. But you know, but it's been a joy. I've actually really enjoyed it. I've become a much better writer and a better thinker, and I think a better person through it. Hopefully a better communicator too. In terms of your question, voice, I think that's up to the reader to think. The reader should tell us whether or not they think that we did a good job with the voice. But I think at least what we were going for was a fairly the same voice in all of the chapters. Yeah. We wanted very much our vision for the project at the beginning was not to have the book be read and experienced like an anthology by different authors, but by one voice and one political, you know, sort of vision, and set of ideas and interpretations, which is not to say me and Sarah Lee probably agree on in terms of interpretation about everything, but for the most part, the book is a singular shared set of narratives around what we're researching. And I think we did a pretty good job with it. I feel pretty good about it, having reread it more times than I care to ever again through the editing process.
More of our conversation with Sarah Lee Stafford and Neil Shirley about their book, Dixie Be Damned, 300 Years of Insurrection in the American South, just out from AK Press, after this musical break. You ready? Let me tell you about these old school Chevys, Cadillacs, SS Impalas. If you smoking, then we got more sacks than Troy Polamalu. Your partners want some quotas, my partners want some keys. In Atlanta, we get that paper, can you hate us, say cheese? 10,000 watt amps, 6 15 inch kickers. My trunk bumping like it injected. Shots like a stripper, no insurance on these whips. Tags all outdated, I might not be to you, but my mama thinks I made it. We gon' ball till we fall. Lord, this conjure get us wasted, and I never drink that white. All my women think I'm racist on that brown with a twist. Tell these to reminisce that my name is Ludacris, and I'm like, let me tell you about this super fly, dirty, dirty, third cold, muddy water. Shout it, pop that if you wanna. Let me tell you about this old school.
Let me tell you about this old school, pouring lean, candy, yes, a collard green. when it folds and folds. Pull up on the scene and I'm acting. It ain't hard to tell, I suppose she chose to send over the clothes. The wigs and shoes, this Charlie Sheen pimpin' too big to lose. Roll with truths and keep girls in twos. Boy, you must have heard wrong where you been confused. See, I'm
so would you say it's the kind of book that someone could just pick up and delve in anywhere? Or is it does it serve the reader more to start from, you know, introduction and go through the whole thing?
Well, I think if you start from the introduction, you get more of a... I mean, definitely. We wrote in the introduction to be read, not as some kind of like aside, which, you know, we spent a lot of time collaborating on the introduction and conclusion, and it was the most fun, I think, for both of us to write those. But no, the thing I love about this book is that you can just pick it up, start, you know, in a section that you already have interest in, or maybe some things inspiring you to read that, and then if you like it, you can kind of read the rest. So I do think that's helpful, especially in dealing with such a big book. You know, I think I don't want the size and like the scope of the narratives to be intimidating or to feel like, oh, I have to read all of this. So yeah, people should read it however they want, really.
I'm going to add one thing on there. I do think, you know, I mean, you could pick it up. You could be in a bathroom, pick up one chapter and just read the chapter by itself and get something out of it. But the chapters are interreferential. They're interreferential both directly in the sense of like, you know, you'll see a sentence that's like, just like in Ogeechee, blah, 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 blah. You know, that's the next chapter or whatever. But they're also interreferential in terms of the ideas. You know, the just to give an example, the kinds of like interpretation we have over conflicts around citizenship and assimilation that occurred during Reconstruction period speak directly and immediately to the kinds of internal conflict and recuperation and containment strategies that the state uses during the civil rights period. And so you would, you know, specifically those two moments, Reconstruction and civil rights, 60s, 70s era, they speak to each other in history, so they speak to each other in the book. You're going to get a lot more out of, you know, reading about those urban riots and the way that the state contains them if you read about the way the state sought to contain conflicts post-Civil War, because the strategies are very much related, and the way they manipulate and exploit and contain black rage, specifically black rage, are highly connected.
Yeah.
And so actually, I mean, the book is very much a unified whole in that sense. And I do hope that people read all of it. So, yeah.
Through a few sections of the book, you talk about the creation of whiteness. Can you talk about race and how y'all tried to handle it in this book?
I think that any book or text that is grappling with the history of the American South, but also the history of this kind of continent, you know, has to directly deal with the forced enslavement of millions of Africans, of the, you know, of the genocide of all of the people that were here before colonizers showed up, and also through that, the creation of whiteness as something separate and a privileged kind of non-identity than the marked identities of people of color that were created through these violent colonial and regimes. So it's kind of like it's not a separate topic. You know what I mean? Like, it's just how we have to look at this history. Otherwise, it's irrelevant, right? So I guess I don't want to treat race as a separate topic. It's part of the narrative and kind of spirit of every single chapter throughout. So I guess in terms of specifically the creation of whiteness, one of the reasons that the Great Dismal Swamp was really important for us or just looking at the struggle on the dividing line of North Carolina and Virginia, is that some of those very first distinctions between the indentured Anglo servant and the enslaved African happened in these territories and in these struggles. So what happened when an indentured white and an enslaved black, well, those terms aren't even used yet, but an indentured Anglo and an enslaved African ran away together? What happens when they're both caught, right? And so the history of how those two subjects are created differently is the creation of whiteness in that early period. And then you see it evolve throughout the book. You want to kind of talk about the evolution of it?
Yeah. I mean, so I really like what Sarah Lee said about, you know, we're not interested in talking about race as like this separate thing or even as a separate product of identity, but as this part of this larger whole of development and resistance that are always happening, you know, in tandem with each other and against each other. And so, you know, we talk a lot about, especially in the earlier chapters, about primitive accumulation as this sort of, it's a classically Marxian concept, but we take a pretty different take on it, and we've been influenced by people's like Silvia Federici's understanding of that, whereby primitive accumulation is not a one-time event, but something that continues to happen over and over and over again. It's sort of capitalism or what the state or various structures sort of constantly weeding the field, if you will, to renew their own projects. And so in much the way that Silvia Federici highlights in a focus on the witch hunts and women's reproductive power and women's bodies in Europe as an often overlooked aspect of primitive accumulation for capital in Europe, the creation of whiteness as a concept, as something which previously sort of disparate groups could gather around, and likewise the creation of different ethnic groups and identities and blackness becomes a part, that process is part of primitive accumulation in the United States. And it's something that hasn't been talked about perhaps as much as it should be, as a way that capital made its own development possible on this continent. Mm-hmm. It couldn't have happened without it. And so on the one hand, that's where you find the origins of whiteness. It's also where you find the origins of black identity, not just as a victim of these forces like democracy or divisions of labor, but also in the process of resisting those forces. So blackness, you know, emerges in places like the Great Dismal Swamp, where people on the one hand are victimized by capital and plantation life and the state, but they're also coming together and forming a sort of pan-African identity vis-a-vis their resistance. Mm-hmm. And so they have direct agency. And that's also something the Marxian narrative of primitive accumulation never takes into account, is the actual agency of the dispossessed. It tends to view them as sort of passive pawns. And we see this process of primitive accumulation also as one in which resistance takes place. And that's the source of a lot of these identities. And so when we talk about race, we're trying to take that larger picture into account. And, you know, whether or not we succeed in that is, you know, up to the reader, but that's what we're going for.
And I like the way that you say on, what is this, page 268, like where you address this, like we suggest, for example, that race in its inherent violence could be framed from a question of identity, reframed from a question of identity and belonging to a method of government. And like where you go on from there, I thought was also another like interesting way of posing it, not only in direct relation to that ongoing process of primitive accumulation, but yeah, very cool. So you get a bit heady and introspective with your views on history, historiography, and storytelling. So what were some of the things you were wrestling with in writing and editing this book concerning, I guess in particular, what I was getting at with that question is, so...
Linear time. We're going to say that on air.
Whoa. So it's going to come out sounding like auga.
That's fine.
Well, I think an interesting thing that happened in writing this book is that there's a theorist, Walter Benjamin. He was an anti-fascist, and I don't want to call him a communist because he would have hated that, but he lived in the early 20th century in Europe, and he killed himself at the border between France and Spain when he thought he wasn't going to be able to escape from the Nazis. He wrote these really beautiful, right before he died, these really beautiful theses on the philosophy of history. And it is a text that I discovered when I was really young and probably really misunderstood it. And it didn't really actually come to make any sense until I was engaged in this writing project. And Neil had also been reading Benjamin and been playing with that as well. And I think, and honestly, I think to give a shout out to the work done by folks on the West Coast who wrote Baden, I think they brought Benjamin into the anarchist context in a really fierce and relevant and beautiful way that made me realize it was okay to read non-anarchist theorists and use them when trying to write a book like this. I think basically the work by Benjamin, by Fichte, by Foucault, you know, names are all those kind of European all-stars are like, we don't use them to try to sound important or to try to like obscure our own ideas. But I think we tried to pull out threads of their concepts of history that just felt really relevant in our context, and more specifically for Benjamin. So our goal in working with such a large amount of material and definitely having to, you know, we had to order the book in a somewhat progressive fashion, just in the sense of dates, but we wanted our actual work to speak beyond that. And so for us, getting away from the linear progressive narrative that Neil was talking about earlier is looking towards a version of writing and doing history where capitalist time, colonial time, all these different structures of time that are that linear progressive narrative break down in these moments of rebellion. And that's the word rupture that we use a lot, right? It's to kind of mark where the time of work or the time of imprisonment or the time of enslavement is destroyed, even just momentarily, by those actors, by those subjects. The difference between something like a rupture, or what we would say, and what we're referencing a lot in the insurrectionary time and the historical materialism of the introduction, and then something like a progressive version of revolt, is that at the end of a progressive revolt, the idea is that these, you know, the subjects are reinstated and are just in a better position than they were before, right? Those are things like rights and things like getting your demands met, right? And then what we're looking at that breaks with that concept of time is the time of the rupture, where you don't return to the same subject position afterwards with just, you know, with just better conditions, right? Life kind of halts for a while, and new life forms and new forms of activity are created. And obviously, we know these are temporal junctures. They don't last, but they're important for us to seize on and to hold up. And it's those memories that get washed under and get erased and get ignored in progressive histories. Is that helpful?
Yeah, definitely. It's also, it seems like, and I hope I'm not just reiterating, but in those moments, if you ever experience those moments of rupture, when the world stops, it's like you can see the potential for a line of flight out of it at that point. It's like you can see that utopia, or that, not, you know, whatever utopia, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think for us, that's where, where, for example, you know, a lot of these writers, these theorists, but especially Benjamin, becomes really exciting because he had a lot of courage to basically break with the Marxism of his day, which was saying that, you know, in his case, communism, a product of these inevitable but gradual historical forces. And, you know, what that does is it takes agency away from us as actual people acting on the world. And it also means that, you know, to a large extent, it's this inevitabilist, despairing version of history whereby, you know, there's not really to be, for example, I remember Orthodox Marxists responding to the Zapatista rebellion when that broke out and was big in the late 90s. They would be like, well, it's really inspiring, but it doesn't really matter because they haven't become proletarians yet. So they can't actually progress to,
or
like,
Du Bois says the
whatever.
Same thing about the Maroons,
right,
in the South.
Right. Du Bois sort of writes off. Du Bois? I always get that wrong. He sort of writes off the Maroon rebellions as this thing where, like, well, they haven't become wage workers yet, so it's like they wouldn't know how to make communism yet, you know. And it's kind of arrogant, and it's also just writing off this period of really important history. And so there's all these, a lot in our historiography, and, you know, in the conclusion, we it is a bit heady, I suppose, but it also, we try and get into a lot of concrete examples as to how that progressive version of history causes historians to ignore really important stuff because they don't find it interesting because it doesn't present any possibility to them of the gradualism they're looking for. And yeah, and to your point, you know, it is the important things in those insurrectionary moments. One thing that's important is that sometimes a riot leads to an insurrection, which leads to a social revolution. So, like, it's not just a visionary, imaginary exercise. Mm-hmm. They do actually lead to real ruptures that can be permanent, right? But also, even when they don't do that, like what you just said, Burst, I really like, is that they are this line of flight. Mm-hmm. You're in this moment behind a barricade and you suddenly realize life doesn't have to go back to normal. The line of flight can go towards any of these things that we have words for, like the commune or anarchy or the wild or whatever. And so doing history differently allows us to see, I think, with more clarity, hopefully, those moments that provide a line of flight. Whereas, you know, for example, doing history vis-a-vis the traditional labor history model, just to give an example, tends to not give you a line of flight so much as a way to see how to press for individual workplace demands. And that doesn't actually provide you with the same kind of line of flight as might a wildcat strike in eastern Tennessee, whereby they burn down all the city infrastructure and steal from the rich. And so it's not just a matter of they're more militant. It actually is the content and substance is different.
And how people are transformed in those moments are different.
Yeah, that's another thing is another aspect of this messianic quality that Benjamin talks about, is that it changes the actors themselves.
Yeah.
And that becomes really important when you talk about all the ways that race and capital and gender and the state have made us who we are. We need those moments of transformation.
Mm-hmm.
We need Fanon's psychoaffective violence to change ourselves. Like, that we have to go through that violent process, otherwise we can't change ourselves either. So there's an individualist component just as much as a collective one. Yeah,
that's good. I like that.
Yeah.
Psychoaffective violence.
That's, by the way, my DJ name.
I was about to say that. Like, that should get. I was about to say that needs to get looped.
Yeah.
And just like a good like beat underneath it. Anyway, this brings me to the question about what is an anarchist historiography, and are you attempting to frame one out at the end of the book in the conclusion, or is it more of a challenge and a call?
I think we attempt to frame it out, but it's definitely through the context of the narratives in our book. And so we don't kind of transpose an idea of our historiography onto just a blanket, like, future concept, if that makes sense. So I think it is a call, for sure. For me, this whole book is a call. I want to see more, you know, anarchists, this work and doing history. And I hope that it's a provocative call in the sense of it creates dialogue and creates more discourse around what an anarchist historiography could be, because I think we're definitely also looking for that in Comrades, and looking to push these ideas and make them better, make them more present to our times constantly as well. But what would you say, Neil?
In its best moments, I think it could be interpreted as a call to new kinds of historiography. I don't, personally, I am an anarchist, but I'm not really highly invested in that word or that, you know, as an identity. And I don't want to, and I'm not particularly interested in, you know, things like historiographies or critiques or things like that being connected to that word. I don't think it's, I question how useful it is. I think for me, I want historiographies that are negative and critical of the things that exist now. I'm sort of less interested in them affirming a singular narrative and then calling that anarchist. I think that would be a step backwards. Anything that presents itself as singular or universal. I mean, I don't think we could substitute an anarchist narrative for a progressive one or for a leftist one. I think that would be futile and a bad, you know, a step backwards. So I'm interested in people writing history and interpreting and taking on that task, like, seriously, as it informs the conflicts we're living in now, because it does. And I'm interested in people doing so in ways that are just as critical and combative as, like, all the sort of fiery polemical communique type things that we read now on the internet in utter abundance. You know, I think people should fight over and delve into these ideas that are historical with that same degree of passion. I guess I would be interested in seeing that. I would never expect a singular anarchist historiography to emerge from that. I would expect a diverse and contradictory array of historiographies to emerge that have certain sort of principles in common, like a rejection of leftism, like a rejection of the progressive narratives that we were confronted with now, and also a rejection of the way that the academy has owned history. That's something we have on the interview, but it's something we've talked about in public discussions and talks that we're hosting with this book. pretty much, I think any time when we go and talk to university, we're probably going to be basically presenting front and center a critique of how the academy owns this material. Because we've had to confront that in our own research as non-academics doing a somewhat academic kind of project. In all the degrees of, you know, the real things like money and time and professionalism and salary and tenure that invoke privilege around who gets to own and do history are something that anarchists should also deal head on with. And that anarchists already have been dealing head on with, as well as a lot of non-anarchists. So, but in terms of the historiography, I'm probably a little skeptical, but I'm and less interested in it being anarchist, but I'm definitely interested in more critical historiographies emerging and having a deeply sort of negative and critical take on how things have developed with history. Is that vague? I don't know.
No.
Okay, good.
Where can people expect to run into y'all on this series of speaking engagements? Do you have a schedule slated?
Yeah, we have the beginnings of a schedule. We're having an actual release party, like a Bacchanal celebration, no formal speaking.
You have to dress up, though.
You have to dress up.
Like what? Like Bacchus?
Yeah,
you toga can do toga party.
We're hoping that people actually bring their like their formal attire. We don't get to see each other in formal attire enough because we're poor. But I think that's May 31st in Durham at the Pinhook. So that's kind of kicking off a couple weeks of local events. So then we'll be Greensboro June 1st at Scuppernong Books. We'll be in Durham June 3rd at the Regulator. We'll be at International, which is an anarchist run. Space in Carrboro on June 8th. June 14th, we'll be in Atlanta at the Hammonds Museum with some people who have been involved in struggles in Atlanta that are actually written about in the book and mentioned in the book. So it'll be really exciting, June 14th. That's a daytime event. And then June 20th in Raleigh at So-and-So Books. We're hoping to be in Asheville in July whenever Firestorm opens and invites us.
Yay.
And then in the fall, we'll be doing some stuff on the West Coast. Then we'll also be doing a big Southeast Midwest tour. And then eventually in the fall, also a Northeast tour. So
we took joy in making the Northeast have to be last.
Last.
Sorry.
Yeah, if you want to see us soon, you got to come to us in North Carolina or Georgia, but we'll come to you later.
Yeah, and you can get the book off of probably AK Press's website. You can also get it from us. I hope you can get it off their website. You can get it from us as well if you come to one of our events. I want to, if it's okay, to do a totally disgusting plug. We also have a poster series that we've put together with a really awesome look named Phil Blank that deals with like four or five of the themes of different chapters, and they're really big, beautiful, like 3 foot tall, full color, original watercolor art themed around like protagonists in different chapters with text that was written by us and Phil. And they're really big and beautiful and wonderful, and they're going to be like sold with the book at different events and stuff pretty cheap. So thanks to P&L Printing for helping us with those, because they gave us a really, really good deal.
Yeah.
Thank you, Denver.
Yeah, what's up?
Yeah.
Well, cool. Thanks so much for chatting. And is there any other disgusting plugs you want to make before we stop recording?
Yeah, go crazy on June 11th. Get real. Yeah. Get hard. Go hard.
Stay hard.
Stay hard. Yeah, that's good. Thanks, Merce. You can edit that out. Yeah.
No, I mean like...
Nope. Yeah. I want to send shout-outs to anybody listening to this who helped us with this project or was a patient ear or who gave critique, because there's a lot of those people out there and we owe so much of this work to them. So thank you to all those people.
Thank you to all the rebels of the last 2 years that have given us inspiration as well.
Yeah.
And go hard, stay hard.
Yeah, that's good verse. Why don't you make that a t-shirt?
Hey, I'd actually be stealing it from Ida.
From Atlanta.
That's okay.
Yeah, they won't mind. We've been speaking with Neil Shirley and Sarah Lee Stafford about their new book, Dixie Be Damned, 300 Years of Insurrection in the American South, just published by AK Press. More about the book can be found at akpress.org. You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3, Asheville, North Carolina. Also on ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bert So Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for critique, criticism, ideas, whatever, at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.